at olli@uiuc.edu.
We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Pines Plus Waterscapes and Nature's Way Incorporated, now carrying neem oil, a naturally organic product with many uses around the home. Information on neem oil is at Pines Plus Waterscapes, Champaign, 355-2266, or Nature's Way Incorporated in Effingham, 800-369-1247.
And good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. My name is Les Schulte. I'm sitting in for David Inge this morning. And with us this hour, one of our old friends, May Barenbaum, is back with us this morning. May is professor and head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois. And so we're going to be talking bugs again today. Phil Nixon was here yesterday. But May is going to talk to you about the advantages of bugs. And so if you have questions about bugs that you may have seen or insects around your home or your property or just in general insect questions, please give us a call. The number to call is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 if you're outside the 217 area code. Good morning, May.
Hi. Always a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's a lot of fun. We have a couple of topics, the things that we were talking about. One of the things I thought was interesting this morning was that I pulled out my cell phone, talk about technology, and showed May a picture of a bug that I had taken here in this building downstairs about 4 or 5 days ago because I couldn't identify it, and I knew you were going to be on the program. And then you pulled out your phone, and you were showing me pictures of bugs that you have taken from around the world. And so it's kind of cool to be able to have your own camera with you. We have some calls coming in right away. Should we get to the phones?
Yeah, sure.
All right, we have a couple of other things we'd like to talk about, too, but why don't we just go to the phones and see what's on people's mind this morning. And line number one from Whiteheath. Good morning. You're on the air with May Barenbaum.
Hi. I didn't get to listen to the program yesterday, so I don't know what was talked about. But I called last year about cicada killers and was told that they're harmless and, they're fine. Well, this summer I have had, like, an infestation you wouldn't believe. And they're all over. They make all these little sand hills all over my yard. I must have 100 or something nests in my yard, and it's just gotten to be out of control. And so is there a good, something good about cicada killers besides killing cicadas? I think I'd rather have the cicadas than these cicada killers because they've just ruining my yard. They must have a huge colony. I must have about 100 sandhills, and my yard isn't that big, really.
Well, actually, they're not social wasps. They're not like hornets or yellow jackets in that they don't really have a colony. They just have individual females that will create nests with her offspring in each burrow. But what you must have is an incredibly perfect set of conditions. They like a certain level of sandiness of the soil, a certain level of water, of moisture in the soil, and they also don't like a lot of cover because the males will patrol and try to keep others outside away from their territory. So what you have is kind of a perfect storm, I guess, for cicada killers seeking places to lay eggs. If you call the extension office, Phil Nixon can tell you about ways to get rid of them. In terms of what good are they? I'm sure cicadas would join you in saying that they're probably a scourge upon the earth. But the way I look at, I have a kind of a twisted view of the world anyway. But to me, I would love a backyard that's full of bouncing, flying, yellow and black striped, colorful insects, which I know is not the majority view. In fact, my husband and I had a dust up. we had some beautiful organ pipe mud dauber nests right by our front door, and they're called organ pipe mud daubers because they take mud and they make these long
columns. I
love those things, and they eat, they kill spiders, that they don't sting people, and he knocked them down. I said, well, they don't hurt anybody, and he said, but our guests won't know that, and in their fear they could trip off the front steps. So we lost our mud daubers. So I can understand why you would not appreciate the aesthetics of having large yellow and black striped flying creatures?
It's just, they go in my, I have this little plot of a garden that grows herbs, and they dig these humongous holes in there. I mean, it's such a little strip. That's all the garden I have because I have all these trees. And they just dig these huge holes, and then they the herbs plants will die because they've been digging such huge holes. I mean, I've got holes all over my yard, and I don't have that big of a yard, and I've got lots of trees. I don't know why they chose me, but well, we even have grub control that comes by, you know, on a regular basis, like once a year or something. That doesn't seem to dent the population, so...
Well, give Phil a call at Extension.
I will.
I think it's 333-6650, I think,
okay,
is the number.
Okay, 6650. Okay.
I'm pretty sure that's the number.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
Okay,
thanks a lot for your call. Let's go to line four. We have a call from Spring Bay. Good morning. You're on the air with May Barenbaum.
Yes, good morning. Well, I'd like to commend you for your testimony in Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago.
Oh, thank you.
And I also saw you quoted in Elizabeth Colbert's article on
In the New Yorker, yeah.
I've got cantaloupe that I grow, and I was out in the patch the other day, and I found a dead bee. And I'm wondering, you know, how's that colony collapse disorder doing in the Midwest? And also, would there be an address, if you know, to send in a sample of a bee or anything like that? And I'll hang up and listen offline. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the question. Just to fill in listeners who haven't been following bee news, last fall a mysterious malady seemed to be afflicting bees across the country, whereby normally colonies have, you know, 30,000 plus workers and a queen and lots of brood or baby bees and packed with, you know, honey for getting through the winter and pollen stores for feeding the grubs. And many very seasoned professional beekeepers were discovering that their colonies, the workers had essentially disappeared overnight. All that was left was a handful of very young workers who are desperately trying to do all the jobs of that are assigned to the colony. And the queen was still there. There were plenty of stores, plenty of food, plenty of brood, and no dead bodies to account for the mysterious disappearances. Moreover, the typical pests of honeybee colonies, like small hive beetles, wax moths, and the like, were scrupulously avoiding these mysteriously collapsed colonies. So people started talking to each other, and this was a pattern that appeared to afflict, well, initially by February, there were about 27 states that were reported. There were about, I think, in total, about 36 states. Illinois seems to be, depends on who you talk to. As of June, the Illinois Beekeepers Association did not believe that there had been an official confirmed case of colony collapse disorder. But Jerry Bromenschenk, who runs a website with a survey, has inked in our state, and apparently he got a report of a collapsed colony. So it's unclear. We were among the last to get to have any reports, if in fact we do have reports, although Indiana was afflicted. Alabama is the only state I know of with absolutely no indication of colony collapse. It's a little vague because since we don't know what it is, we can't really confirm it with any certainty. Congress just approved, actually, the House just approved a bill to allocate funds to try to investigate the causes of this. In the meantime, even before there was any funding available, about 60 investigators got together, tried to figure out what logical or likely hypotheses were, discounting things like cell phone for which there is absolutely no evidence, for changes in the Earth's magnetic field, which didn't fit the epidemiology, Osama bin Laden, which we could discount for other reasons, so all kinds of hypotheses. The last I've heard about actually, you know, progress, there is a rumor, not a confirmed accepted manuscript in a peer-reviewed journal, but there's some indication that there may be a novel pathogen, and it may or may not be associated with the introduction of deliberate importation of Australian bees in 2005. Now, this is not confirmed. It's not in a scientific journal. And I don't know why it isn't yet, because I heard this about a month ago. So, there are many people. There's a whole panel of genetic tests have been done comparing collapsing colonies with healthy colonies using the new genome technology that's available because the honeybee genome sequence was completed in October. And Jay Evans at the USDA just looked at various sorts of stress genes, immune response genes, and can find no differences between collapsed and not collapsed. So, you know, there have been mysterious collapses in the past, going back to the 19th century. And there was one in the mid-70s, which actually mapped onto the general pattern of this year's collapse. And in no case was a cause ever found. So I was hopeful that our modern technology would help us zero in on the cause, but I'm not sure that we're going to have it's a race now to see if the phenomenon disappears before we can figure out what it is. So, but I think that was everything in the question. Was that that? Oh, in the New Yorker article, I have to say, my brother is a New Yorker, and I found out I was quoted in this New Yorker article when he sent me an email. And he was indignant that I wasn't quoted until the last page. Like, I don't have to be in every article about colony collapse disorder. I'm not technically even a bee biologist, but that was it was a very very interesting article by a woman who got so interested in this phenomenon that she started keeping bees. So it's an account of how she managed to take up beekeeping as well.
Okay. Our number to call is 333-9455, or if you're outside the 217 area code, 800-222-9455. If you have a question for Mae Barenbaum, professor and head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I. Let's go to line two, and we have a call from Belgium this morning. Good morning. You're on the air with Mae Barenbaum.
Yes, good morning.
Hello.
Ms. Barenbaum, we spoke a month and a half ago, and I was describing a childhood experience I had when I lived in Panama, and we were talking about a grasshopper, a very large grasshopper. Now, I have to admit, I'm not an entomologist, and what I might call a grasshopper, I'm sure you probably don't, but it looks like a grasshopper to me, okay? And I was telling you that it was about, you know, it was about as big around as a garden hose, 3/4 of an inch in diameter, and it could not turn around in a mason jar, a quart mason jar. And you said, "Oh, those things are only in the movies." And I said,
"I said that."
No. Yes, ma'am. Yes, yes. We talked about Gibson City, and and I said, "Well, okay. Well, as fate should have it, a couple of nights ago, I'm watching one of these high number channels, you know, like Discovery Channel or something, and there's a gentleman who is finding insects in some high pass in either Nicaragua, Honduras, some place right near Panama, and lo and behold, what he has in his hand is exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh, wonderful.
It was 5 or 6 inches long, looked a whole lot like a grasshopper, had red wings that I did not remember. You know, when you spread open their wings.
did he call it a lubber? By any chance, a lubber grasshopper?
It may have been. I didn't catch the name he said. I was just so jumping up and down. There it is.
Well, I apologize. You know, when you described it the second time, maybe I don't know how big a quart mason jar is or something. But
a quart mason jar is probably about 8 inches tall and probably about 3.5-4 inches across, okay?
Yeah, so 3.5-4 inches, that's maybe I was thinking of the 8 inches or something. But but lubber grasshoppers, even in the United States, the southeastern U.S., can get to be, they probably weigh about as much as a small mouse. They're very chunky kinds of, and they are true true grasshoppers. It's what entomologists call grasshoppers as well. And I certainly don't know all tropical species, so if I said,
well, I just wanted
taint
to say
so, I must have had a bad day or something. So.
No, I was just trying to get at the point that these grasshoppers have now invaded Central America. They've moved from Gibson City. The other little item I'd like to talk to you about, and I also talked to you about another time, about we were talking about buffalo gnats.
Oh, yes, yes.
And I have found now that they seem to be somewhat prevalent in southern Illinois. The people down around the Carbondale area find them fairly regularly. Are these things spreading?
Well, it's hard to say, to say spreading. What they may be doing is coming back, because what simuleids, those are the, you know, that's the scientific name of the family of buffalo gnats, actually like clean, fast-running water. So that's why we don't have them here. We don't really have any clean, fast running water.
Well, our water is much cleaner now, but it's not very fast running.
Yeah, but and there are places where there has been pollution that's been cleaned up and the water does move, then the buffalo gnats or simuliads may be making a comeback.
These things are some serious pests.
Yes, they are.
They are painful.
Well, simuliads are among the... There's two ways that blood-sucking insects get blood out of their hosts, and the more sophisticated, delicate approach, they're called vessel feeders. They're like mosquitoes, and they have mouth parts that are built on the same principle as a hypodermic syringe. They inject an anesthetizing substance, tap into a capillary, and just pull up a small quantity while injecting an anticoagulant, because a clot would form, you know, if a clot formed, it would block their mouth parts. The other approach, they're called pool feeders. These have very strong mouth parts. They basically drill a hole in you that's so deep that the blood flows freely before it clots. And those are the ones that hurt. Horse flies, black flies, have these sort of stiletto-like mouth parts they just use to punch a hole in you. And then they also all share this characteristic. All pool feeders share this characteristic of being very stout-bodied and pestiferous. So, you know, mosquito couldn't really stand up to a slap because they're all spindly and they get squashed. But horse flies, you know, buffalo gnats are small, but they are compact. And, I mean, they look like, you know, I guess a typical gnat on steroids or something. They're really sort of chunky build. And they are pesty. They won't go away when you swat at them. That's because they, you know, hang around and lap up the blood before it starts to clot. So they're the ones that hurt. And they also are capable in some places of carrying parasitic organisms, filarial parasites. So they are vectors of a disease called onchocerciasis, which is what they're little worms, actually, that the flies are the vectors for, and they can cause blindness in Central and South America, for example.
Do we have that around here?
No, we don't. No. there's something to be grateful. We can be grateful to winter, cold Illinois winters, for many, many things. Cold winters save us from a lot of truly horrifying things that are common in the tropics. And one reason I'm not happy about the prospect of global warming is that a lot of things are extending their range northward that otherwise just could never make a living here.
The host I went over and visited with over near the Illinois River, near the Spoon River, is where I was at, he called them he called them flying chiggers.
Well,
they are just that insistent.
And they are. And what I don't like about getting bitten, I don't know how other people react, but the sites of the bite swelled.
Oh, yes.
Like tumors, you know. Mm-hmm. They were very unsettling, to say the least. So
they take a while to heal.
They sure do. They're not my favorite either. I mean, I like insects, but, you know, really hard to think of nice things to say about black flies. Although they, you know, they're an important part of the food chain, you know.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for your call. If you have a question for May Barenbaum this morning about insects or bugs, give us a call at 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. And let's go to line one. We have a caller from Urbana. Good morning. You're on the air with May Barenbaum.
Morning. I hate those black flies. I just have a question. I'm sure it's probably fairly common, but we have a wood picket fence, and I have been noticing over the past couple of years especially a type of hornet, I believe, that bores up into the wood and nests. Is this a common hornet to this area? Or?
Now, I've heard of hornets taking sort of wood splinters to process to make their big nests out of. That's why they're gray, those nests. It's basically reprocessed wood from fencing and the like. And I know of carpenter bees that bore into, they like soft wood.
That's what it is.
Yeah, I don't know of any hornets that are nests and fences, but certainly carpenter bees do.
Well, what do they look like? Because this thing looks, it's like black, Looks like the wings are black. It looks more like a hornet to me as far as color goes, but its body's a little bit more
chunky.
Maybe bumblebee.
Yeah, that's exactly what. That's what carpenter bees look like. They look like bumblebees.
Yeah, and it's really odd because they literally bore and they leave. It's like you would drill
a perfectly round hole.
Yeah, and what I've been doing is, well, I don't know if this is a good thing or not, but I've literally been breaking sticks off and up in the holes, whether they're in there or not, you know. So I don't know if that's, is there any way to rid yourself of, you know, self of them? Or?
Well, again, that's a question for extension entomologist Phil Nixon. I don't know if he got these calls yesterday.
Okay.
I think it's 333-6650.
Okay.
I don't really keep up with, you know, it's really a very specialized and challenging field to keep up with all the regulations about what chemicals can or can't be used for what insect pests. So.
Right, and I try to steer away from any chemicals.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, if I have to break a stick off and hope they go away, you know, that'll work better to me. So.
Well, the nice thing about most insects is come winter, they usually do go away. So.
That's true. Okay, well, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call. The numbers are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And let's go to that toll-free line, and we have a call from El Paso, Illinois, this morning. Good morning. You're on the air with May Barenbaum.
May, I got a couple of questions. Number one, there's a wasp, I believe, that has lives in a hole. Anyway, there was a hole in the ground, and it looked like wasps flying in and out of it.
Oh, there are actually quite a number of wasps that live in the ground.
Oh, okay. Then it would be difficult. I would have had to capture one, too.
Yeah, do you have any sort of recollection of what it looked like? Or?
No, I was on the fly, and so I just saw them happening, and I just wondered if there's never a number of them, I'll just have to go look it up. The other one I have has to do with a bug that looks like a small pea pod. I mean, a lima bean pod. It's about a light green, and it's about 2 inches long. It's about an inch high, and it's very thin. And
by thin, how do you mean thin?
As opposed to long, tall, and thin. Okay.
Is it stick like, or is it?
No, it's not really a stick. It looks like instead of a walking stick, it looks like a walking pea pod.
Okay. Oh, well, when you first described that, it's sort of a light green, right?
Yes.
What it sounded like to me is something called the southern green stink bug. Is it sort of shield shaped? Like a pea pod would be sort of like a shield, or?
Well, shield. I don't know exactly what you mean by that. It is.
Sort of triangular?
Well, no, it's just more like a rounded back and, you know, flat on the side. And I'll tell you, it's a good-sized bug. I mean, it's not a little one by any stretch. It's a good 2 inches long, and it's about an inch tall, and then just very thin.
And not fuzzy or anything?
Nope.
Yeah.
Not that I noticed, anyway. Not obviously fuzzy. Because I played with him. He went on a ride with me going, he was on our car. So I'm in the garage, and then we went on a ride. He got on the car, and we went down the interstate, and, you know, we were 20 miles away, and we noticed this bug was still with us, and we traveled with us all day long, and then all of a sudden he disappeared.
Maybe a commuter or something. Like that. So I'm just showing less than, I don't know if you go online and look up the southern green stink bug. They're not 2 inches, but I mentioned that one because the light green there, I saw one yesterday, actually. They're fairly common this year, and it is a very distinctive sort of light green color, and they're they're flat. I mean, they they don't have a lot of dimension to their, you know, they're not round, you know, rounded or anything.
No, no, not at all.
Would you call that a pea pod kind of looking thing? Or,
what I'm thinking of is a lima bean pod. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that would be my guess. And they are plant feeders.
Oh.
And they have sucking mouth parts that they use to poke into plants and suck out the, you know, the juices.
Okay. I just don't remember seeing one around here before, and I thought, well, I'd wait till you came on.
Well, that's my best guess.
Thank you. Bye.
And they're called stink bugs, by the way, because if you had sort of picked it up and roughed it up, it has a pair of glands on its sort of middle of its body that release odoriferous substances. They're actually not repulsive. They're kind of vaguely floral, but I guess if you were eating it, it wouldn't be that tasty. So don't recommend eating them.
All right, it's 11:31. We're about halfway through the hour here. Our guest during this hour of Focus 580 is May Barenbaum, professor and head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I. If you have a question for May, you can give us a call. Our numbers are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Let's go to line two and line one. Okay, line one from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air with May Barenbaum.
Hello. Hi. I think I have a monarch butterfly question. So outside my kitchen window, there's a milkweed vine that's kind of vining around a volunteer tree, and I noticed a black and orange butterfly that looked to me like a monarch kind of fluttering around it this last weekend. And then a few hours later, my hose caught a piece of this vine, yanked it off, and I noticed that there were some little, like a couple of rows of little tiny orange eggs. And I'd be really happy to have a monarch growing, but it's obviously not going to use the torn-off piece of vine, but there's some other vine surviving. So what I did was to put the probably dying vine back and just lay it over the living one in hopes that the eggs will eventually hatch and find nearby milkweed flowers and stuff and do their thing. Is it likely to work?
That's exactly what I would have done, actually. If it was an orange and black butterfly laying eggs on a milkweed plant, dollars to donuts. That's a monarch butterfly. It's just about the right time of year to see them laying eggs for this last generation. This is the generation. Those caterpillars will be the ones that grow up and then head off to fly to Mexico in September. So that's timing's just about right. And all they eat is milkweed. So that was. I know there are lots of kids who find a caterpillar and put it in a jar with grass. And, of course, you know, the caterpillars may as well be in a jar with rocks because they just don't eat anything other than milkweed. So you did exactly what I would have done is rather than dislodge the eggs and risk damaging them, just lay the detached bit of vine across healthy vine. And the caterpillars know what to do. That's about all that's their job is to find food to eat. So they should they don't have to look too far, and that's just exactly what I would have done.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot. Let's go to line two. We have a caller from Danville. Good morning. You're on the air with May Barenbaum.
Yes, good morning. Kind of ironic he was talking about milkweed. We grow milkweed for monarchs out here in the rural Vermain County, and I know what a monarch caterpillar looks like, but what we have on these milkweeds right now is just massive numbers. They're little woolly worms. They're predominantly black. Oh, they have like little fuzzies that stick straight out. In the four corners, there's white fluff that sticks straight out.
Yep.
And then down their back is an orange stripe.
Yeah, I'm just trying to look up the scientific name, which I'm thinking is Eucetius eggli, but I'm not exactly sure. It's not here anyway. Yeah, that's an Arctic caterpillar. You just nailed it. It is in the same family as the woolly worms, and it's this brilliant orange, white, and black fluff. You know,
it's like a fuller brush.
Yep, and they live in groups, and you wouldn't dream of eating them because they don't look the least bit appetizing. That's because, just like the monarch, they store the cardiac glycosides in their bodies. I think they're called milkweed tiger moth, actually, I think is their common name, Eucetius eggli. And that's where you find them is on milkweeds. And
so it is a moth?
It'll turn into a tiger moth, a pretty moth, actually.
Okay.
So.
All right. I didn't know. It's they're really stripping the plants down this year.
Yep.
Time.
Yeah. Well, they live in these groups, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they aggregate. So I can see if you're trying to save them from monarchs that the milkweed tiger moths would be an annoyance.
Yeah, they're a bit of a pest, so to speak. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for your
thank
call.
You.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to line number three and a call from St. Joe. Good morning. You're on the air with May Barenbaum.
Good morning.
Hello.
I have several questions just regarding insects in general. Dimensionally and mass-wise, what are the largest insects known today, and what is constraining the insects to be such small creatures versus the reptilian family and so forth? That's all I need. I'm going to hang up and listen to you.
Well, you know, just like baseball fans like to quote statistics. There's sort of a running discussion among entomologists as to how you measure who's the biggest insect. And, I'm sorry. Eucheius aglea is the right name. But just checking my names. I get salt marsh caterpillar and milkweed tiger moth mixed up, but nobody cares. Okay, so back to the biggest. Okay, so heftiest, that's usually the criterion used, is greatest mass. It's a toss-up between one of the Hercules beetles from tropical. Actually, there are species that live, the very largest is about, maybe reaches 6 inches to the tip of its, has these elaborate cuticular projections on the top of its, near the top of its head. And they weigh about as much as a mouse, 3 ounces or 4 ounces. They there's also the New Zealand weta, W-E-T-A. It's a very primitive, enormous ground cricket, very massive sort of thing, and that very odd life history. They're very tolerant of cold temperatures. They live up in the mountains. And some people will argue that the wetas are the biggest, heaviest insects. The longest insects, there's a New Guinean walking stick that's about 13 inches long. The widest wingspan is a moth in the, Thysania, I think is the genus. It's also Central American, Central South American, has 11-inch wingspan. Largest butterfly is called a birdwing butterfly, comparable wingspan. They're really gorgeous. So what do you have? Longest, heaviest, what else? What other ways can you measure things? They're all kind of, people are constantly sort of vying for the top spot here. I'm not sure what it gets you, but.
Kind of like now, the Barry Bonds of bugs or
exactly,
something like that.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no artificial means to pump up your bugs are allowed. Now, the reason why, this is one of the, you know, sort of fundamental questions of the, you know, bedevil entomologists. And funny you should ask, because just, I think, a week ago, in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, was a wonderful study that just came out that shed some light on this idea. And it's long been suggested that one of the limitations on the size of insects is their respiratory system. They don't use, like we use, a circulating fluid that has an oxygen-carrying pigment. So our blood cells deliver oxygen, which is bound to hemoglobin, the red pigment, to all the, you know, throughout all the tissues of our body. And it's a circulating fluid in a closed system. And that's not how insects work at all. They don't have a closed circulatory system. It just sloshes around in the middle of the cavity. So they can't have high blood pressure, but then again, they also can't deliver this fluid with oxygen. So instead, they have a system of tubes lined with cuticle, the same stuff that lines their outside, that branch into finer tubes, that branch into even finer tubes that basically deliver oxygen directly as a gas to each cell of the body. Now, in a large insect, these tubes take up a lot of space. I mean, oxygen delivery in air is much more efficient and much faster, about 100,000 times faster than in water. So the question is, at what point does it become inefficient because those tubes, the system of tubes, is just too long, it's too hard to shed that exoskeleton? Well, what the investigators did was to model how, well, you've seen those fossils of Meganeura, the fossil dragonfly, the wingspan of 2 feet. Nobody's that big these days. The question is, we know they existed. We have the fossils. How'd they get so big? And it turns out that the oxygen levels in the atmosphere back in the Carboniferous when Meganeura was flying around – were about 30% higher than they are today, which means that the tube system doesn't have to be as big or as cumbersome. So it may well have been that the oxygen-rich atmosphere 250 million years ago could support larger insects because their respiratory system could accommodate it. So that's the latest view on why we don't have 2-foot-long or 2-foot-wide dragonflies buzzing our ponds, which I think most people are kind of happy about.
Oh, I think so, yeah.
But a very timely question. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. The numbers are 333-9455 or outside the 217 area code 800-222-9455. Let's go to line number one and a caller from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air with May Barenbaum.
Good morning. This is actually more of a comment than a question. I'm not sure, but when the gentleman was describing the bugs here a little bit ago, two inches long, 1 inch tall, looked like a liner bean pod. I was thinking, actually, that he was suggesting, rather than it being flat horizontally or thin horizontally, it was thin vertically. Obviously, I haven't seen the bug, so I don't know. But that made me think of, aren't there bugs that imitate leaves? And
Yeah, actually, stink bug is only half an inch long. It's not 2 inches long, but sometimes people can't guess. But if that's what he was thinking of, I would it probably was a katydid, because katydids do get to be about 2 inches long. I wouldn't call it a lima bean pod, though.
I don't know. But that's what I was thinking, that perhaps he was thinking of something like that.
And if it were flat, we would call it, entomologists say lateral instead of dorsoventral because we just like to throw around Latinate words. But, if it's side-to-side flat rather than top-to-bottom flat and 2 inches long, it could well have been a katydid. They're also that light green color.
Yes.
Good point.
Sure. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to the toll-free line, and we have a call from Vincennes, Indiana. Good morning. You're on the air with May Barenbaum.
Yeah, hello. I had a question. It's not an insect question exactly, more of a spider question. But I walk along, paths by the creek, walk the dog and so on, and never fails that you run into spider webs.
Mm-hmm.
Also see spider webs near porch lights and so on. And I was wondering if it's known how spiders choose where to place their webs, because they always seem to place them where insects are flying, in these open areas or where light is at night. Things like that. Has anybody done tests to see what cues the spiders are using to find out where to put their web rather than just put them willy-nilly anywhere?
Actually, there's been quite a lot of work done, and spiders will take their webs down and move them if their return rate isn't. Just like a fisherman, he casts in a spot and there's no nibbles, he'll just walk down the stream and cast another, do more casts. So many... there's so many different spiders, so many different ways of spinning webs, but generally the orb weavers will take their webs down at night and relocate them. There's a problem. That's not true for some of the ones with the really massive, huge webs, but the average garden spider they eat their webs, recycle the silk, and put them up the next night. It's kind of dangerous to leave your web during the day because when there's day flying birds will fly through. You, in fact, probably destroyed somebody's, hours of work there. But some spiders will put in, you'll see these little sort of zigzaggy, very thick threads that stand out. I don't know if you ever noticed there. They're called stabilimenta.
Oh, sure.
And there were people for years thought they were put in as struts or scaffolds, but they seem to be visual signals to large flying insects and birds to stay out of the way, because it's a real drag to have your house get, traipsed through on a regular basis. But yes, spiders do have a way of figuring out whether their catch rate is high or high enough, and then basically moving if it's not.
Okay, great. Thank you.
That's amazing.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Well,
it is amazing.
Their life depends on it. So.
Mm-hmm. It's 11:45. We have about 10 minutes left to the program. If you'd like to give us a call, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And let's go to line number two. We have a caller from Champaign County. Good morning.
Good morning to you. I have two different questions. I haven't seen Luna moths lately, for years, in fact.
Yeah, that's...
Have they gone extinct?
No, they haven't gone extinct. But the whole family, they're called giant silk moths, family Saturniidae. They're the big, you know, they, this family contains the really spectacular, the Cecropia moth, the Io moth, the Polyphemus, and the Luna. All of these moths have apparently been in decline over the past few decades, to the point where if someone sees one, it's like, you know, get an article in the paper. Like, they're, and
it's been,
what's
at least 10 years.
Yeah, what's suspected to be responsible, at least in the East Coast, what's been suggested, back in the early part of the 20th century, when gypsy moths had were really expanding their range and causing massive defoliation of New England forests, the idea, this new method at the time of biological control was being promoted. And in the typical American attitude of, you know, if a little is good, then more is better, which we now know is not the case for many things, this encouraged people to go over to Europe, where gypsy moths were native, and bring over tons of native enemies, of natural enemies of gypsy moths, including a fly called Compsellura concinnata. It's a tachinid fly, in a family of flies that parasitize other insects. So this fly will lay her eggs in the body of a large moth, and the maggots will develop and consume the moth from the inside and destroy it. Now, yes, Compsellura concinnata will attack gypsy moths, but gypsy moths have only one generation per year, and this fly has multiple generations. So it needed other moths to attack, and it will attack hundreds of other species. And it's particularly fond, apparently, of the giant silk moths. So these parasitic flies are now widely established in the eastern U.S. and appear to be parasitizing the giant silk moths and maybe contributing to their now apparent rarity.
I'd like to ask about the flying green shield, 3/4 to an inch long. The American dung beetle, is it?
Oh, well, there's a, it's called the southern fig beetle. It's this brassy sort of olive green. It looks like a little bit like a Japanese beetle, except it's...
It's bigger than that.
Yeah, it's bigger.
Wider. And,
yeah, it's wider. Its wings are actually...
Noisy when it flies.
And, yeah, and it's really a distinctive color, this sort of...
green.
Yes, yes. And interestingly, too, at least to an entomologist, the whole order Coleoptera, all 300-plus thousand species, are characterized by what are called the elytra, their first pair of wings. The wings are hardened and case-like.
A carapace.
And they're not used for flying. They don't flap. They just hold them out, and their hind wings do the flapping. Well, the southern fig beetle actually has fused elytra, so they don't even hold them out. There's a little slot where the membranous wings come out and flap. So they're unusual in that respect. So.
They don't appear to forage on anything. What is their common diet?
Well, the you know, as immatures, they live like so many of the scarabaeid beetles. They're grass. They live on grub roots. They're grubs of that feed on the underground roots of a lot of. I think they are also grass feeders like the scarabaeids. I can check on that. They're called sometimes called southern fig beetles because the adults will go to occasionally will go to spoiled fruits. They like. You know, Japanese beetles also like fruits.
We've got outdoor compost. We probably feed them with the outdoor compost.
That could well be.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you.
It's 11:50. We have about 6 or 7 minutes left. Let's go to line number 3, not there. All right. So if you'd like to get in, we'd probably get one more question in or so. The numbers are 333-9455. Or 800-222-9455. Before we...
I was going to say before we go...
Mm-hmm, sure.
Go ahead. Don't know if he asked about the smallest insect, but I feel obligated
to
time here. Insects actually span about 5 orders of magnitude. This is, amazingly enough, it was one class. The very smallest insect, well, the biggest insect is as big as a mouse or a sparrow, the smallest... is a mimarid fairy fly, they're called, a mimarid wasp, tiny wasp that lays its eggs inside the eggs of other insects. And they are smaller than an amoeba, than a one-celled protozoan. and yet they have six legs, two pairs of wings. They're pretty amazing.
Wow. All right. Well, we've got a call from Champaign. Let's see if we can get that in before the end of the show here. Good morning. You're on the air with May Barenbaum.
Good morning. May, I wonder if you could talk about the Silphium weevil. I had an email from a person asking me about that, and I surfed the web and found a little bit of information, and I remember John Bousman telling me about it. But could you talk about whether the juveniles and adults, of the behavior of that and where they lay, the adults lay their eggs?
I should be able to talk about that because there is a graduate student in our department who actually did a master's thesis on the Silphium weevil. Silphium is a plant in the daisy family, very common prairie plant around here. And the weevils, you're right, there's not much known about their biology. I don't know what more I can say about them other than the fact they live, I was trying to remember, I read the master's thesis. But I'll tell you who knows about it. If you really want to get the latest on the Silphium weevil, call her advisor. Send him a note. That's Larry Hanks, is my colleague at University of Illinois. Hanks, H-A-N-K-S.
Sure.
And he, his graduate student was working on the, in fact, he had a number of graduate students working on these prairie plants, sort of conservation-oriented projects.
Okay.
So he can fill you in on the latest on the Silphium weevil. How do you come to have an interest in...
When you're out at prairies and you see compass plant and prairie dock, you'll see that the very top flower head dipping down and all the resin sap oozing out. And I can't remember if I know the weevil cuts the stem and the head falls over.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wasn't sure if the females then actually lay their eggs in that flower head.
I believe that's what they do that, and in part to disable the resinous defenses of the plants. You know, this is kind of a common tack all the way from monarch caterpillars that snip the latex channels so that the milkweeds don't ooze, to the weevils that clip the flower heads so that the resins can't flow, to bark beetles that basically overwhelm pine trees so they don't drown in the resinous sap. So it's one way to disarm the defenses of the compass plants.
Sure. Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for your call. We have just a few minutes left to the program. And do we have a call coming in? We have one coming in. All right, why don't we go to that right away? Line number 2, you're on the air with May Barenbaum. We just have a couple of minutes left.
Okay, I'll make it quick. Hi, May.
Hi.
I can't get enough looking at spider webs, especially in the morning dew, the geometry of them, just like the amazing geometry of a cactus, or, you know, whenever you see regular geometry in nature, you wonder how that's genetically controlled. And I was just wondering what's known about, I'm sure that each spider has a certain genetically programmed geometry that it displays out in its web construction. What's known about how spiders do that sort of regular construction?
Each species does have sort of stereotypical behavior, stereotype behavior. So the basic pattern of web construction is the same, you know, every day and every place. But they do have the capacity to make adjustments for most species, depending on the exact, you know, the precise geometry of the spot where they put up their webs. So there are all different types of orbs, but one particular species of spider will make a characteristic type of orb web. And they're really, it's quite an amazing, even more amazing than it looks, just because of its geometric precision. There are different types of silk. Spiders can spin over a half a dozen different types of silk. You may wonder why a spider doesn't get stuck on its own web, because it knows where the non-sticky silk is. So there's sticky silk for capturing, there's non-sticky silk, there's the barrier silk, there's, you know, supporting strands, there's, they can put in, UV absorbent pigments so that certain large prey will avoid them. It's just an amazing process. And there's certainly behavioral, it's certainly stereotype, but you can disrupt it. And very popular studies in the, I guess, 60s and 70s were to administer mind-altering substances to spiders to see what effect it would have on their web-spinning behavior, because it is so predictable. And it's amusing to look at these old papers and see the webs that are spun on caffeine and the webs spun on LSD are kind of what you might predict. So, but
kind of vague pharmacological results, I'm sure. But I wonder, because the radii, the angle of each radius is so perfect, mm-hmm. and the spacing of the concentric circles is so perfect. You know, one wonders how the spider is measuring, you know, now I should make a new radius and now I should make a new ring. You know, it's just the precision of the measurement. One wonders what's going on. They're not carrying protractors, you know, so how do they do that?
Well, a similar sort of question arises as to how honeybees make those perfect hexagons when they make their wax cells. So that's one thing that'll keep us entomologists busy for a long time. We got a lot of mysteries to solve. So.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks
a lot.
Thanks for your call. We really appreciate it. And I guess that's going to do it for today for Focus 580. May Barenbaum has been our guest. May, thank you very much. Fun as always. And my name is Les Schulte. I've been sitting in for David Inge. And the markets are next.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Pages for All Ages, Books, Music, Cafe, and DVDs, located at the corner of Route 45 South and Curtis Road in Savoy. Pages for All Ages offers a wide selection of books, compact discs, stationery, magazines, DVDs, children's books, and gift ideas, and features a full line of coffee, drinks, and teas at Pages Cafe. On the web at www.pagesforallages.com.
This Saturday, WILL is hosting Home Movie Day, part of a nationwide celebration of home movies as documents of family and community life. Film experts from the University of Illinois Library will assess your 8 or 16 millimeter films and offer guidance on preservation and reformatting. Best of all, we'll screen examples of archival films from Central Illinois history. Bring your films or come just to enjoy the screenings for Home Movie Day at WILL's TV studio in Campbell Hall from 1 to 5 this Saturday here at WILL Urbana.
Tom Rogers is sitting in for Celeste Quinn on the Afternoon Magazine this afternoon. Tom?
Hello there, Les. And in our 1 o'clock hour, we're going to have an archived interview with Celeste, talking with Linda Faria, who tells the story of her coming of age in the Midwest as a Japanese-American in the memoir Bento Box in the Heartland, My Japanese Girlhood in White Bread America. We'll hear that interview coming up in the 1 o'clock hour at 106 Central Time. In the commodity markets right now, we see the wheat hitting 11-year highs at the moment, with the nearby September wheat contract in Chicago now up 12.5 cents a bushel at 691.5. Corn and bean prices down today because of possibly some worries about the short-term lending business in the outside markets, hurting things all around today. But as we mentioned, September wheat in Kansas City is up 9 cents at 671. The September in Chicago, as we mentioned, up 12.5 cents. And the December contract up 4.5 cents in wheat at 705.5. In the corn, September is currently at 333.5 a bushel, down 7.5 cents. December at 350, down 8. March corn, 366, down 7.5. And May corn is at 376 a bushel, down 7.25 cents. August beans are at 853, down 2. The September soybean contract at 858.75, down 3.25 cents. November at 874.5, down 3.5. January beans at 888.5, down 3.75. August soybean meal is at 230.80, that's up 50.